From the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC, this is The Frame. I'm John Horn. On today's show, a look back at the career of Boys in the Hood filmmaker John Singleton, who died today at the age of 51. Then filmmaker Rachel Lierz followed four women, including a waitress named Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, as they mounted insurgent grassroots campaigns for Congress in 2018.
They were all challenging political machines in different parts of the country, you know, just kind of in situations where it's like, that is not done. That's just not what you do.
And Avengers Endgame isn't really the end, so what's next for Marvel? All that coming up on The Frame. The filmmaker John Singleton died today at the age of 51. He suffered a stroke on April 17th, and today he was taken off life support. Singleton burst on the scene in 1991 with Boys in the Hood, one of the first films to capture the reality of young men living in South Los Angeles at that time.
Parents always trying to start some s***. We always trying to find some excuse to shoot somebody.
That's why fools be getting shot all the time. Trying to show how hard they
are. Oh, fool, shut up. You be doing that too.
One of the film's co-stars was Ice Cube, who had been a member of the group N.W.A. Between N.W.A.'s album Straight Outta Compton and Singleton's film, with its rap-heavy soundtrack, hip-hop culture became firmly established in American culture. The movie was released by Sony Pictures and grossed nearly $60 million. At the time, a stunning return for a film made by and starring African-Americans. Singleton was the first African-American to receive an Academy Award nomination for directing, and at the age of 24, the youngest to be nominated for original screenplay. Singleton went on to work on a variety of projects in film and television, including as executive producer of the 2017 documentary L.A. Burning, The Riots, 25 years later. Joining me to talk about John Singleton is Franklin Leonard. He's the founder of The Blacklist. It's an annual compilation of the top screenplays that are not yet produced. Franklin, thanks for hopping on the phone.
Wish I was joining you under different circumstances, but glad to be here.
I guess we should start by Singleton not only directed Boys in the Hood, he also wrote its screenplay, and there's a story that he was offered a lot of money to have someone else direct it. What was the story?
You know, I obviously have no direct knowledge of it. I was 13 when the movie came out, but what I've read as recently as today that he was, and he said that he was not going to have someone from, and I quote, Idaho or Encino directing the story of these young black men in South LA. And what I assume he was 22 at the time when he made that decision, I think it speaks to the thing that for me defined John, which was a sort of unwillingness to see anybody tell these stories but the people who knew from whence they came. And I think that that was a relatively new phenomenon in this business, along with Spike Lee, who had done She's Gotta Have It just a few years prior. And I think it defined his career. It was one of the many reasons why I admired him. And it's frankly a bit confusing that he's gone.
What stands out for you about the writing in that script? What was he able to do that was so authentic?
I just think that it was authentic, and it felt like these were people that I knew or that I could have known, and they were three-dimensional and complicated and had wants and needs. And, you know, at the time, that was not something that was terribly present in the film or in the film culture of this industry. And I think that it was the beginning of that becoming more common. And I think that it's staggering to think that the person who was a part of that beginning was only 51 years old in 2019 and is now no longer with us.
At the time that Boys in the Hood came out in Hollywood, there were hardly any black directors working, and certainly even fewer who had the chance to make studio films. Do you think his success with that movie created an opportunity for other filmmakers who followed, even if it's still taking a long time for a lot of people writing checks to get on board?
Undeniably. I think that the success that he had opened doors because it meant that success was possible. But I think even more than that, he represented for those of us who, you know, even considered a career in this business, that it was possible. And that you could do it in an uncompromising way without sacrificing who you are and the stories that you wanted to tell. I'd be hard pressed to think of a single black filmmaker working in Hollywood today, for whom Boys in the Hood didn't have a profound impact in terms of what was possible. And I think he and Spike and a few others were the harbingers of the beginning of a movement in that direction. And I know I personally will forever be grateful.
The other thing that I think is notable is that John Singleton worked with a lot of musicians, including Ice Cube and Tupac Shakur. Particularly in Boys in the Hood, he curated a soundtrack that really reflected the sounds of Los Angeles at the time. What do you think about his collaboration with musicians and how he incorporated their stories and their lyrics into the movies he was making?
Yeah, I think that speaks to, again, the authenticity of the stories that he was telling. Those cultural environments don't exist without the music that also defines them. And I think that he was bringing, the music of the culture into the film culture, into the broader culture. You know, I think that it raised the awareness of artists and it raised the awareness of that culture to a broader world that has since embraced it. But, you know, he was early in that regard.
You mentioned you were 13 when Boys in the Hood came out. Do you remember watching it for the first time and what it felt like to see it?
I do. I mean, I was living in West Central Georgia, but it definitely, it felt real in a way that other movies that were telling different stories felt. And it felt good to see a film that had people that looked like me and my family, you know, 40 feet high in a theater. It just wasn't something that you could do, walk into a movie theater and see a story like that. And I think that it continued, whether it was Poetic Justice or Higher Learning or Rosewood, telling the stories of African-American history that had never been told on screen before. He was doing something that no one else was doing at the time that he was doing it. And it's, I don't know, like I said, it is profoundly confusing that he is no longer here. And at 51, I'm frankly mourning the things that we will never get from him as a consequence.
Franklin Leonard is the founder of The Blacklist. Franklin, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
The filmmaker John Singleton died today at the age of 51. As we go out, let's listen to some of the soundtrack from Boys in the Hood.
It's your life. Don't be stupid, though.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. Before Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was a congresswoman from New York and the co-sponsor of the Green New Deal, she was a waitress who challenged a powerful Democratic incumbent and his political machine. The documentary Knock Down the House follows her and three other women as they ran for Congress in 2018, Corey Brown from Missouri, Amy Valela of Nevada, and Paula Jean Swearengen from West Virginia. Those three attended the film's premiere at the Sundance Film Festival, which is where I sat down with Rachel Lierz, who directed Knock Down the House. She said she started the film not knowing if any of these women would succeed.
A verite election story, you have no idea what the outcome's going to be. You need to find people that are going to be really compelling to watch no matter what happens. And so we were looking for candidates that had very personal experiences motivating them to run. And the idea for the film had originated in the fall of 2016. I really wanted to find some kind of hopeful story politically that would touch on national themes, people coming together across a range of backgrounds, geography, to really create some kind of really big change. And I reached out to Brand New Congress and Justice Democrats, groups that were recruiting ordinary people to run for office, to really create a new path to the halls of power for people who don't usually get there. I did a lot of interviewing over the phone and some in person with a couple dozen candidates, and ended up focusing on these four because of their personal stories, because of their charisma, and because of the different kinds of geographical and personal diversity that they represent.
What did that mean in terms of physical production? Because you're following a candidate in New York, one in West Virginia, one in Missouri, and one in Nevada. So do you have different crews? Are you traveling a lot? How did you piece it together logistically?
Yeah, well, we're based in New York, so we were very fortunate to be able to begin filming with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez before she'd even finalized her decision to run for office. And then in terms of traveling to cover the other stories, it was mostly myself filming. We did have two fantastic additional cinematographers, one in New York and one in Las Vegas. But I traveled with Robin Blotnick, my husband, who's the producer and co-writer and the editor of the film, and our 2.5-year-old son, all around the country filming this movie, and it has been crazy.
You started making this film in the wake of the 2016 election of Donald Trump as president, and you started making it as both a filmmaker and as a citizen. Focusing on what you went through as a citizen of this country, watching these four women, how did that change you personally in what you saw in both their successes and their failures?
Well, from the beginning, I was looking for a story that would provide some hope to cut through the cynicism and disillusionment that a lot of people were feeling in the wake of the 2016 election. But I also wanted to tell a story that would address the root causes of this historic moment of political volatility that we find ourselves in. So all of the issues that these candidates are running on, they didn't start with the election of Donald Trump. We're talking about money in politics, police accountability, economic inequality, environmental justice, healthcare inequality, and lack of access to healthcare. You know, these are the issues that have been, there really shouldn't be issues in the richest country in the world, but they are. And so I think that I'm always wanted, part of the genesis of the project was to find people who were fighting in unexpected ways to change the country and to really put forward a positive vision of what a more just and equitable nation could be.
All four of your candidates refused to take corporate money, and fundraising and putting together a campaign without money is one of the unifying themes of what they're doing. And at the same time, you're making a movie that in some ways is following the same model. You're like trying to figure out how you're going to get your next dollar to do what you are doing. Did you feel yourself kind of united in that cause as you're filming them, that you are following very similar tracks, even though you're doing very different things?
I love that you asked that. I really felt that way a lot. And we had a lot of conversations about the parallels between independent filmmaking and grassroots campaigning. You know, it's hard to get funding for a verite documentary at the early stages when there's no sense of what the outcome is going to be, just as it's really hard to get people behind you when you're running for office. And in the cases of our characters, they were all challenging political machines in different parts of the country, you know, just kind of in situations where it's like, that is not done. That's just not what you do. You do not, it's seen as impossible, right? So, so they really relied on small dollar donations and volunteer labor to really pound the pavement. And in Alexandria's case, of course, she won. And but the others, not only did they changed the conversation in the races they were running.
We're talking with Rachel Lears about her documentary, Knock Down the House. This is in part hypothetical, but it's in part a question that you must have asked yourself while you're making the movie. What if all four candidates lost?
That is definitely something that occurred to us. We had kind of a moment in the winter, spring last year where around this time last year, wondering whether the project was even going to move forward. We've been working on it for about a year. And coincidentally, around the same time, I think Alexandria was wondering, she almost quit her campaign. You know, you've been doing this thing kind of just by yourself for a year with very little backing, and you have these moments where you don't even know if you can continue. And so we decided, all right, we're going to do a Kickstarter campaign to fund the bare bones of the primary season, and then after the primary season, we'll have a sense of whether the project is viable. What happened, of course, was that our Kickstarter campaign generated a really lively audience and really confirmed to us that the project was viable, I think. And that was before any of the elections had happened. But then just a couple of months later, with the primary results in New York, it, of course, catapulted the project to another level.
Your cameras are with the candidates at a lot of different moments in their campaign. And there's a moment where you're with Alexandria on the night of the primary election. And your cameras are with her when she sees what is happening. The look on her face is pure joy, surprise. There's so many different words I can describe it.
How are you feeling? Can you put it into words?
Nope. I cannot put this into words.
You're behind the camera filming this. What are your feelings as you're watching this person that you've spent so much time following be validated by voters and give you the film that you always dreamed of, and I guess maybe even personally the outcome that you might have hoped for in the election?
Yeah, well, first of all, that was a really fantastic scene to film. I had a second camera person, David Sampliner, and he was right where I wasn't, and we were able to really capture the whole thing from two angles, and it was just a dream to be able to cover that. It was such an incredible emotional release. I'd probably been up for 22 hours straight. You know, it was such a draining process, both for the people involved in the campaign and for those of us working in the film. And no one expected the results to come in that early, and it was just every emotion you can imagine.
But you know what? We meet a machine with a movement, and that is what we have done today.
When Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez tweeted that she was unable to attend the festival, she tweeted this, I'm quoting it, "For almost 2 years, a mom followed several women as we ran for Congress. I was one of them." She didn't call you a filmmaker. She called you a mom. And I don't think it was random. What did it mean for you to be called that? And why was it important, if it was, that she recognized you first as a mom?
Alexandria is all about elevating the voices of ordinary people and having a conversation around the common humanity of people who are struggling across this country. And I think by, you know, in other tweets, she's identified me as a working mom. And to me, the fact that she identified me as a mom is a mark of respect for mothers. And, you know, I brought my son here to Sundance. I brought him to the red carpet last night. It's really important for me to speak openly about the struggles and the joys of producing films with a little kid in tow.
A lot of your film is not just about the candidates, but about their families and how they are shaped as people and as politicians by the people who raise them and the people that they are raising. And there's a moment toward the end of the film where one of your candidates visits the U.S. Capitol and talks about a trip that she made with her father many years earlier. Why was it important to include, and what does that say to you about families and how these women were shaped by the people who raised them and the children that they raise?
We're all shaped by our families and communities, but each of these four women in particular are shaped by very specific experiences with it, with their families and communities. And I think the scene you're talking about, I don't want to give too much away, but visiting the Capitol as a child can be an experience of coming into contact for the first time with the idea of what government is and what it should be and what it can be. And that's very much what the film is about. What does it look like to build this path that allows access to the halls of power to people who don't usually get there?
Rachel, thanks so much for coming in.
All right, thank you so much for having me.
Knock Down the House is on Netflix and in select theaters starting on May 1st. Coming up on The Frame, what's next for the Marvel Cinematic Universe?
This land is your land. This land is my land. From California, well, to the New York Island. From the Redwood Forest.
Welcome back to The Frame. I'm John Horn. As you might have heard, Avengers Endgame had its opening weekend. It is a massive box office hit that caps off more than a decade of Marvel comic book films. But after all that time, Marvel is ending its current chapter called the Infinity Saga. But as is often the case in Hollywood, where there's money, more movies will come. And with a record-breaking $1.2 billion in worldwide ticket sales in its first weekend, Endgame certainly took in a lot of money at the box office. To talk about what's next for Marvel, we got LAist arts and entertainment editor Mike Rowe into the studio, and we started by asking him how fans have been reacting to this major installment in the superhero franchise.
The fan reaction has been huge. It's a very emotionally cathartic movie. You know, this is the 22nd of these Marvel movies, so it's been a lot of years. People have invested over a decade in this franchise. So, you know, a lot of people are getting very verklempt at coming to the end of all of that.
Yeah, the movie is called Endgame, and knowing what I know about Hollywood, that may be the name, but that doesn't mean the reality. But that said, there is a new generation of what's going to happen in the Marvel Cinematic Universe going forward. Basically, what are going to be the major changes in the next couple of years?
You know, some of the major characters from this franchise that have been there since the beginning, their stories are resolved, so they're going to be not being seen in the rest of these films, but they're setting up new characters. We have the Spider-Man movie, which they actually say is the official end of this phase of Marvel movies that comes out in a couple of months, so we're probably going to see some questions resolved there that we haven't seen resolved in Endgame, and then they're going to keep making more movies. They have to do this, though, without some of their franchise players. They have to get people to care about brand new characters.
So this is the 22nd movie in this kind of, I don't even know what we would call it. Universe seems unfair, this galaxy. I want to play something from the first character who really got all of these things going.
Truth is, I am Iron Man.
So that's Robert Downey Jr. And that film, the first film directed by Jon Favreau, really got all of this going. And we're not going to have Robert Downey Jr. to kick around anymore, are we?
No, they definitely wrap up his storyline. They wrap up Chris Evans, who plays Captain America, wrap up his storyline. But it's interesting, you know, the one thing that was really powerful about Endgame is that they really reference every single one of the other movies that have come thus far. You know, you get references back to that I Am Iron Man moment. It makes you feel like it all mattered all this time.
And certainly the first iteration of movies were driven by white men. It was Iron Man, it was Thor, it was Captain America, but now Marvel has characters like Captain Marvel, played by Brie Larson, Black Panther, played by Chadwick Boseman. Is it also going to be true that we're going to see a lot of either new or current characters who are not white guys?
I think that's a big thing that they are counting on with this next phase of movies, is trying to diversify things. They have a Black Widow movie that's been in the works. There are going to be more female-led, more diverse movies. You know, they also announced Shang-Chi. It's going to be their first Asian lead in a Marvel movie. They're doing more of these projects, trying to diversify the cast, and that's really the future of the Marvel Universe.
Okay, a couple of different things are happening right now within the Walt Disney Company. One is that they have acquired most of the film assets of 20th Century Fox, and that includes a couple of characters that I'm very fond of, especially Deadpool. So have they said what they're going to do with Deadpool? Because Deadpool is an R-rated character, and Disney typically does not make R-rated movies. So what's going to happen with that part of the Marvel world?
You know, they haven't announced yet what they're going to be doing with the rest of the Fox characters. Fantastic Four, X-Men, Kevin Feige, you know, head of the Marvel movies, has said that he is going to wait a few years before tackling the X-Men. You know, there's so much in the Marvel Playhouse that they can play with now. They have all these new toys. You know, they put a few toys back on the shelf with Iron Man going away and so forth, but now they have some new ones to open up and make lots more money with.
Well, and the other thing that Disney is doing is, like a lot of studios that used to give their content to Netflix for ancillary revenue, Disney is now bringing all of that content back. And it's not just Marvel, it is Lucas, it is animation, and they are going to put a lot of that content on their soon-to-be-launched streaming services. Some of it will be library content, but some of it is going to be new. Have they announced specific plans of how Marvel will shift kind of from the theatrical world into this new streaming platform?
They have announced a bunch of new shows for Disney Plus. Plus, there are new other ones that we have heard reports that are in the works. There's a Loki show in the works with Thor's brother, a Falcon and the Winter Soldier show. So, spinning off those characters, there are things you can actually see happening in the Endgame movie that seem to be setting up some of these shows, like that one. So, it's interesting to see like a feature film setting up TV shows, sort of spinning off in the opposite direction that we usually see this happening.
So it took 21 previous movies to get to Endgame, and it did feel like it was the culmination of something, and I think the box office numbers validated that idea. How long is it going to take till we get to another Endgame-like moment? Because if Avengers and this iteration is kind of going away, what are we talking about? Years? Another 11 years? Another 22 movies?
You know, I really think it did take this long to get everybody this emotionally involved. Also, they were playing with really popular characters that have, like, a long history in the comic book. Especially, like, you know, everyone already knew who Captain America was. You know, they're establishing new characters, and they're going to have to make you feel that same way about these characters. So I think it's going to take a number of years. It's going to need some time to marinate.
The other thing that Disney is getting with the Fox assets is the next, I don't know, 2, 3, 4, however many Avatar movies James Cameron is working on right now. So Avatar has the current non-inflation adjusted box office record, $2.78 billion globally. Last question, is Endgame going to break that? I say yes. What do you think?
I say yes. You know, I was skeptical going in, but the thing that made Avatar and movies like Titanic so popular was people kept going back
to
them. And I think Endgame's similar in that there was such an emotional feeling from that. People are going to keep going back to this, and it's going to have huge box office numbers.
Yeah, CinemaScore, which does exit surveys of movie fans as they leave a theater, found out that the fans who went to see Endgame gave it an A+. Not a mark that you see very often, so I think you're right. There's going to be a lot of repeat business for this film. Mike Rowe is the arts and entertainment editor at LAIST. That's KPCC's website, LAIST.com. Mike, thanks for coming in.
Thank you, John.
And that is it for today. Remember, you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You'll find us at The Frame. I'm John Horn. Thanks for listening. We're back here tomorrow.